My mom worked for somebody who happened to have a biplane. I thought we were doing okay in Chesterfield. He must have been like the Lord of Chesterfield because this man had a biplane. So he like took us up on the plane and we flew around it. I was super young, so it's kind of a hazy memory. But I even remember then being like, are we sure this is safe? Like if Harrison Ford can't do it, what chance does this guy have?
Right.
Welcome to the Oddity Archive with Evan and David.
Other than that one time flying, we went there more often than not because mom liked a restaurant within the airport.
That is where I was going with this. Chesterfield, Virginia has a very small local airport. So that's the context for Evan's story. And I had known there was a restaurant in this airport like for a long time, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but like last week it just popped in my head. I was like, I need to try the Chesterfield County Airport buffet.
You've never been before.
No, I'd never been before. And so we've determined that Thursday is buffet lunch day, and we're all going to go to the Chesterfield County Airport buffet. And I don't know what to expect. It has good reviews, but I don't know.
I'm not trying to knock the clientele, but like, what's the next closest restaurant even? There's like nothing in that area, unless there's something in the shipping yard out back.
Well, hold on. Back up now. Okay. Have you been in that area lately?
No, that's fair. I haven't been back home going that far south, east, west, whatever it is in a minute. But do you want to know about the food that I had? And then you can, update me on.
Yeah, the goings on.
So I did the buffet and I remember a lot of pulled pork and like mac and cheese and kind of like those kind of staples.
Okay, I'm down.
My six-year-old child brain seemed to enjoy it.
Okay.
And I was pretty classy back then.
So good reviews from 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. I remember it not being too bad. Yeah. But I was trying to remember the name of the actual restaurant because I thought it was like King's Cross or King's Corner, but that may have just been some other place I went.
Yeah, it's King's Corner.
Is it actually?
Yeah. King's Corner Buffet. Yeah. That's a good memory.
Yeah. So I don't know how I remember that. We must have gone more often than I remember. Mom's probably like, it's Wednesday. It's buffet day. Get in the car. Yeah, but you'll have to report back and let me know what you think, because yeah, that's a very deep core memory for a young little Evan in Chesterfield, Virginia.
So you would be absolutely shocked if you drove through there right now, but that like mile stretch of road has exploded from the main road all the way to our elementary school. They've cleared the whole thing.
I have periodically like kind of gone down that way. It's been a long time. I mean, maybe like a year.
Yeah.
But I do remember driving me like, I thought that was like a forest. And then it's like this huge Kroger or like a car wash. So that side's a little depressing. Just like they cleared all this stuff for that. But also, I think we kind of knew it was inevitable growing up. It was going to kind of turn into that someday.
Yeah.
But yeah, seeing how much stuff is there now compared to what it used to be like it was pretty desolate back in the day from what I remember anyway.
There's now a Sheetz, a Panera. They're in the process of building what's the Asian fast casual place?
Panda Express. Yeah.
There's a Starbucks, a Chipotle, a Cava.
Okay. So it's got all the things.
And they're right now building like a whole hospital or like standalone ER or something that they're putting in over there.
Okay. I feel like I did see that. Interesting spread. And so you can go to the hospital and then pop into Chipotle or Cava and, you know, pick that up on the way home from your surgery.
Right. Yeah, that place is getting developed.
So I don't know how to paint the picture of this airport. And also, I'm now remembering like what our previous episode was that we're wrapping up. Now I'm like, oh, that's why he's talking about the world's smallest airport and me going up in a biplane with my mom's boss, as you do. But it was like private jets, maybe really, really small ones, not like a G6 or whatever, but that. And then just like little tiny planes is all I kind of remember, because the Richmond airport really isn't that far away from there. And that's like the big, well, bigger one. It's still kind of small, but
the Chesterfield airport's really just like hobbyists, I would say.
Yeah. Still just kind of a weird thing to exist there, but
it is.
I'm kind of curious now on like the deep history. Maybe that'll be another episode we do. There's got to be a ghost or two bopping around over there.
We'll do an airport and buffet review at the start of the next episode.
We'll bring on my mom's old boss as our guest. And he's going to go, what is it?
Oh, tell me about your biplane.
He's got to be like 400 by now. So if he is still around, he will be a ghost. remember when I took your son up in the biplane and then you all got the barbecue buffet? That's what I assume he'll sound like.
After we reanimate him.
Like a Weekend at Bernie's thing, but, you know, we'll have him fly the plane.
Nothing could go wrong with that.
Yeah. Okay. So this feels like a good natural segue.
So when we left off, part one, Amelia Earhart, they had just taken off from Malay, New Guinea, mm-hmm. and they were heading for Howland Island.
Yes.
And I think I covered extensively that Howland Island is like a very small, uninhabited island. When I say very small, I think it's like 1.5 square miles.
Yeah.
There's no vegetation on the island. It's just like a 1.5 square mile sand dune in the middle of the ocean. And so tonight we're going to go over the theories of what may have happened. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, there are two theories that actually have some legs. And then one more theory that you can kind of see the logic behind, and a fourth theory that's just absurd.
Okay.
The first theory that I'm going to go over is helpful because it kind of walks us through what we know about the final flight.
So this would fall under one of the two theories with proper logic involved and not...
In my opinion, yeah.
All right.
I'm starting off with this one because, one, it's the simplest, and two, it gives us a chance to kind of just talk about everything that we know happened during the last flight up until them disappearing, obviously, because we don't know what happened.
Right.
All right, so a couple of things before takeoff on the last flight.
Mm-hmm. And that was going from...
So they landed on Lay, New Guinea. And then Howland Island doesn't really have a nation attached to it. I don't know what country technically controls that like patch of sand in the ocean, but...
But they're real committed to it with the landscaping. And
yeah. And so they landed in Lay, and they had 2, maybe 3 days before they took off for Howland.
Mm-hmm.
They were originally supposed to take off a day earlier, but they didn't want to take off into the weather that was going on. There are also some reports that Noonan, Fred Noonan, the navigator,
mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned in part one that he allegedly had an alcohol problem.
Yes. Yeah.
There are some reports that he may have gotten a little too drunk one night and they didn't want to take off while he was like really hungover the next day. So for one reason or another, they waited an extra day or two before they took off for Howland Island. Now, a couple of things about while they were on Howland Island. A lot of this information comes from what's called the Chater Report. Chater.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing I'm going to read is a direct quote from the Chater Report. And it's just really to give you an idea of the detail to which they were making sure they were controlling everything they could so that this flight was going to go well.
So can you give us like a quick, like just mile high view, like what is a Chater Report? Is this like a release thing with an incident or?
Chater, I think, is somebody's name.
Mm-hmm.
After the disappearance of Amelia, he sort of compiled everything he knew about the case into this report.
Okay. So a personal kind of dig into the story to try and explain it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so this is from the Chater Report, and this is the chief engineer's notes about work he did on the plane before takeoff. And I think it just helps to show, one, they knew what they were doing. Two, they were checking, making sure this plane was in tip-top shape every stop that they could.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of long, but I'll go through it as quick as I can.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is the chief engineer's report that is listed in the Chater Report. Clean set of spark plugs fitted to both engines. Oil drained from both tanks. Oil filters inspected and cleaned both engines. Petrol pump removed from starboard engine on account of fluctuation of pressure at cruising revolutions. Spare petrol pump fitted. Thermocouple connection on number 4 cylinder starboard engine repaired. Air scoop between numbers 2 and 3 cylinders on port engine repaired. Propellers greased. Batteries inspected for level and charge. New cartridge fitted to exhaust gas analyzer starboard side. Spare adapter plug fitted to carburetor air scoop for temperature gauge line. Spare gyro horizon lateral and fore and aft level removed, cleaned, oiled, and replaced. As this reported showing machine in right wing low position when actually horizontal. Engines run up on ground. Petrol pressure on starboard engine too low. Petrol pump removed. Original petrol pump valve and seat ground in to remove unevenness. Pump fitted to engine. Engines run up on ground and tested in air. Both engines okay. Petrol pressure port engine 4.5 pounds. Starboard engine 4.75 pounds. Engines, instruments, and aircraft approved okay by Miss Earhart. So they did a lot of work.
Yeah.
They were going through this thing meticulously to make sure the plane is in tip-top condition.
I mean, obviously, I don't think Howland Island has a chief engineer just kind of kicking it. So was there just ones along the way that they would stop at? Or was this guy flown there from California to be at that stop or something to facilitate their return home?
I believe the latter.
Okay.
The whole circumnavigation of the globe was a major undertaking by Amelia Earhart, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the U.S. government helped out a lot with this. And so it would not surprise me in the slightest if the U.S. government flew out whoever she wanted to lay New Guinea to work on the plane when it got there.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense.
Yeah, so again, plane is good. This isn't like somebody didn't check the spark plugs correctly and like one of the engines blew up or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't foresee that being a problem. The other thing that's worth noting is that the radio communication that they had on the Electra, which is the plane she was flying.
Mm-hmm.
Neither Amelia Earhart or Fred Noonan were very good at radio communication. And what I mean by that is neither one of them knew Morse code at all.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the standard for navigational radio communications at that time was Morse code. And so they both needed plain English through the radio. They couldn't communicate via Morse code. And I guess they realized too late into going around the world that they never updated their radio plan. If you remember, they flew from, I believe, Oakland to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Navigator Manning, they were still on his radio plan rather than having switched it to Noonan's radio plan for navigation.
What do you mean by a radio plan?
Like how to communicate, what verbiage to use, when you can use Morse code.
Okay.
They had a whole plan for how to communicate via radio.
Gotcha.
And so some wires could get crossed via radio communication.
Yeah. So is Morse code just more, is that signal able to get through stronger than a vocal radio signal? I assume there's a reason, and it's probably because it's easier to send out a single tone versus whatever would carry a vocal wavelength, right? It's got to be something about signal strength, I would assume.
Yeah, I think that would be it. Another note from that report, and I don't really know what the first part of this means. I'll just read the thing. Transistor carrier wave on 6210 KC very rough. Miss Earhart was advised to pitch her voice higher to overcome distortion.
Okay, yeah. So now I'm starting to see why they'd be like, are you sure you don't want to do Morse code? No, we're going to be fine.
Yeah.
So technology limitations, that makes total sense.
Okay, so plane's ready to go. Radio communication can be a little bit spotty, but they're ready to take off. And so the morning comes, they take off from Ley, New Guinea, and because they're going to travel across multiple time zones, I'm just going to list this out on how many hours into the flight things were happening.
Gotcha.
They had enough fuel for 20 to 24 hours of flying time.
What was the expected travel time in comparison?
I think it was a little bit less than that, maybe 18 hours.
Okay. I don't know if they were it's 2 hours, but we're just going to load you up just in case.
No, so this was the longest leg of the trip. So it was every drop counts.
Right. And I think you said they made the plane super light, stripped it down, right?
Yeah, they basically took everything out of the plane except for a bucket for a toilet and gas tanks.
That's right. Okay. Just trying to make sure we repaint the picture from episode one or whatever to get us back in the space.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so there's a bucket to pee. And
they're essentially just flying a gas tank through the air. I think it was a normal Electra holds 200 gallons of fuel, and this one was at 1,100. So it was a wild amount of fuel that they had on board.
Yeah.
And it was so much, actually, that when they took off, they were really just cruising along the top of the water for quite a while. Mm-hmm. Because they're using ground effect to stay up rather than the wings just letting them float through the air.
Well, I'm sure they burn more fuel at the start when they're heavier, but as you lighten up and stuff as you go, all that stuff. But
yeah.
Okay.
And so for a while in the flight, they're cruising at 1,000 to 2,000 feet. They're slowly gaining altitude. altitude because of how heavy this plane is with all the fuel on board. And so the first radio communication comes at 4 hours, 18 minutes into the flight. And it is Amelia Earhart saying, "Everything okay." That was one of her catchphrases, probably not the right word, but that was one of her like go-to lines. Mm-hmm. "Everything okay."
And to make sure it came across, she would do it in falsetto.
Yeah.
So
everything okay then. At about 5 hours, she notes increasing cloud cover, which is starting to affect the navigation. So if you remember, Fred Noonan was one of, or probably the best celestial navigator in the world.
Yeah.
But if you can't see the sun, you can't see any stars, you can't see the moon, you can't determine your heading. You can't determine which way you're going.
Yeah.
And around the same time, the sun starts to rise over the horizon. And so they're flying directly into the sunrise. And the glare could have affected some visibility for navigation also.
Yeah.
So already you're 5 hours into the trip. There's some things that could be messing with the navigation.
Gotcha.
Also, because they noticed the cloud cover was increasing, and when you're that high up, you can see like a storm system really far off.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ended up diverting course a little bit and having to fly over Bougainville Island, which was not part of the initial plan. And you wouldn't think of random islands in the South Pacific as having like high mountains or anything, but Bougainville is actually a very mountainous island.
Mm-hmm.
I looked it up. The peak is just under 9,000 feet. Standard cruising altitude for this flight was set to be at 10,000 feet. However, they had to divert around this storm and go over Bougainville Island. So just having to go off course, that's going to burn a little more fuel.
Yep.
And then having to go up an elevation, probably a few thousand more feet, because you don't want to be flying over a mountain at 1,000 feet altitude. So that's going to burn a little more fuel than they had planned. And then at 7.5 hours into the flight, they radio again and they say they are more or less on course. Everything's going well.
Less confident than the previous message already.
A little bit less confident. And also, there's no GPS at this time. There's no radar tracking them.
So no one knows where they are. It's purely just landmarks, mapping, and communication over audio. That's about it.
Right. I should have led with this, but the theory that we're going over all of this for is called the crash and sink theory. And so that's kind of self-explanatory.
Yeah, I imagine it's what it sounds like.
They crashed into the ocean, sank, and everything's been lost since.
Yeah.
There's 7.5 hours into the flight when they say, yeah, we're roughly on course. That's all self-report. There's no way for anybody to confirm if they actually were on course or not.
We have to just take their word for it, basically. Yeah. Like, they have been wildly off, but this is the best we've got.
Right. Because, like, right now, like, if you got on a plane tomorrow, you could send me the plane information and I could track it every second of your flight, wherever you're going. But obviously, in 1937, that didn't exist.
You mean when I text you, "Hey, David, still on course?" You don't believe me.
Yeah, I want you to start sending me like old-timey navigational text messages. "Heading south southeast, 14 knots.
I need more peanuts, stat."
Okay, so that's 7.5 hours in. They report they're roughly on course. 8 hours in, they had figured they would be flying into about a 12-mile-an-hour headwind. And they actually found themselves flying into about a 25-mile-an-hour headwind.
That still doesn't sound too bad, right?
It's about double, but...
Yeah, but I mean, expectation versus what's dangerous, that sounds not that...
No, not dangerous. Really, the point here is that the fuel consumption.
Oh, right. So more drag and more...
More drag, okay. Yeah. So we've had a little bit more fuel used, having to go over Bougainville Island and divert around the storm. We have more fuel being used to fight this doubly strong headwind than they were expecting. And so around this time, cloud cover is getting so bad that celestial navigation is pretty much impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And so Fred Noonan has to rely on dead reckoning. That's the other type of navigation that he was really good at. Find a fixed point somewhere so you know where you are on a map. Then you know your direction, your speed, and you can calculate where you should be.
With heavy clouds, still has to be not the easiest thing to pull off.
Right. And any little error is going to compound, because if you're flying 2,000 miles and your math is off by 1 degree, by the time you get to your destination, you're going to be way off.
Yeah. You know, if you get turned around, you might be flying the wrong direction.
And so also at this time, and sort of to the note of Dead Reckoning being the only navigation, the USS Ontario, the United States had parked it about halfway to give them like, hey, you're going the right direction.
Okay.
This is a fix that Noonan can use for continuing out into the Pacific Ocean. And this would have been about halfway. What they didn't know, but what we know now, is that just 40 miles north of the USS Ontario was the USS Myrtle Bank. A different ship that was not related to this flight in any way, shape, or form. And they were similar boats from 10,000 feet. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
Yeah.
And so it is possible that with the issues with celestial navigation, having to divert around the storm, that they could have spotted the USS Myrtle Bank thinking it was the USS Ontario.
Yeah.
And that would have thrown off the Dead Reckoning navigation completely. So that's kind of one point where things could have gone very, very wrong.
That's the weakest USS name I've heard, too.
The Myrtle Bank?
Myrtle Bank, Myrtle Bank.
Also the USS Ontario, named after a Canadian place.
That at least has a nice little flow to it.
I like it. Just, you know, it'd be like the USS Paris. I like to think we name the boats for different places and they're like themed that way.
Inside the boat?
Yeah, like the USS Paris. You get French foods.
Yeah. Myrtle Bank, it's just what, like buffalo wings and potato chips?
Like, wait, where are you putting Myrtle Bank?
Myrtle Beach.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
I figure it's a bank from Myrtle Beach. I'm just picturing the cuisine there a little different than Ontario.
And because it's a bank, you have to take out a loan every time that you... I don't know where I'm going with that one.
Develop it.
Yeah. You have to get a dining plan.
Yeah.
You get so many swipes per day. If you go over on swipes, you overdraft.
I'm sorry, bro. You get no nugs today.
I just turned the USS Myrtle Bank into like a college cruise. Where was I? Okay, so they're only using Dead Reckoning.
40 miles north was the other ship, so that may have been a decoy situation.
Right, and so that's at 10 hours, and then we don't hear or know anything else for 5 hours, and then at 15 hours, the cloud cover is so bad that they end up having to descend to 1,000 feet to try and start spotting Howland Island.
So, communication... Do we know how that was happening at this point? Or is this what the assumed trajectory was based on what we were able to like kind of reformulate looking back?
So if you remember, there was a boat stationed at Howland Island called the Itasca. And the Itasca had a whole radio setup. Like they had a whole like mini city there waiting for them.
So they were still able to communicate despite weather and all that stuff.
So kind of, sort of. This was a really like... famous thing that was happening. Amelia Earhart was incredibly famous. And so like every amateur radio user in the world was trying to listen in to Amelia Earhart.
Okay.
Now there's not a whole lot of them out in the middle of nowhere Pacific.
Yeah.
But they were able to receive messages from Amelia.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the Itasca was receiving messages from Amelia. They could hear the stuff she was putting out on the radio.
Okay.
And so that made it into the report.
Yeah.
Now, one of the issues is the Itasca had no evidence that she could hear them.
Mm.
Because they were trying to communicate back.
Well, and they probably have like a huge radio tower. This is like a little biplane flying out.
Yeah.
I imagine they don't have the same capabilities as something on the ground.
And all the other issues that they had with like the radio setup and the transmitter and everything. Something wasn't working correctly with the radio in the Electra. And so Amelia could broadcast out and tell people things.
Mm-hmm.
But the Itasca could broadcast out also. But there was never any evidence that Amelia could hear the Itasca.
Okay.
There was no two-way communication. The Itasca was trying to communicate back to her.
Yeah.
But she never acknowledged them.
When you hit that point, it's just like, well, I need to keep radioing because you just never know what's going to come across. And it's not like there's some like cache of what you said before that's going to go somewhere, right? It's in the moment. Either you hear it or you don't.
Right.
So I just have to keep checking in. So hopefully it gets picked up at some point between A and B.
Exactly. And so Amelia, I guess, via radio communication indicates that the cloud cover is so bad that they're going to descend to 1,000 feet and start trying to visually look for the island. At 10,000 feet on a clear day, it would be about 100 miles to the horizon. At 1,000 feet on a clear day, or in this instance, just below the clouds, it's about 20 miles to the horizon. So your vantage point is greatly reduced by them having to come down and get below. So they would have had to be within, 20 miles, I think, is a stretch, because if something's on the horizon 20 miles away, you're not going to really see it all that well. But even then, to be within 20 miles of this tiny pinpoint island, that's asking a lot.
Yeah, just like a curvature of the earth thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, how are you even going to see it?
Exactly. And so that's at 15 hours. By 16 and a half hours to 17 hours, so an hour and a half after Amelia Earhart indicates they're dropping low to try and visually sight Howland Island, there's no indication of them. And so the Itasca starts firing up. It had these oil boilers, I guess, for the engines. And so they started firing those up intentionally to send as much smoke as they possibly could up into the air to sort of be a beacon for Amelia.
Yeah.
Again, they knew that Amelia wasn't responding to them, but they started sending coordinates via the radio, you know, like we're at south this degrees, west this degrees. So they're trying to send out some things to help Amelia along the way.
Yeah.
And then at 19 hours, 12 minutes, we get one of the last messages from Amelia Earhart. We must be on you, but cannot see you. Gas is running low. And at this point, just based on that message, they believe they should be very close.
Does the Itasca have any response, even though she may not hear it? Like, we don't see you, or, I mean, I guess that's what it would be, right? It's just like,
yeah, we don't see you. They're responding.
Yeah.
So that's 19 hours, 12 minutes. And if you remember, they had 20 to 24 hours worth of fuel.
Mm-hmm.
But if you factor in having to divert around that island, gain some altitude for that, and also the stronger headwind than they were expecting.
Yep.
The length of time they have for gas is coming down. And then at one point, 19 hours, 42 minutes into the flight, we might be aging ourselves here, but
no.
If you've ever like been in a car and you're listening to the radio and you're going on a long road trip, eventually that radio signal is going to get weaker and weaker and weaker. It's not going to come through as well.
Yeah. Or it starts merging with the next station.
Yeah. And something else will start merging in. Right. And so this is sort of the opposite effect. The signal started coming through so strongly and clearly that staff on the Itasca actually went outside to look for Amelia's plane, including the head of radio communication on the Itasca, Lieutenant Leo Bellertz. He, I guess, was interviewed in response and said, her signal was coming through so strong, I went out and looked for the plane.
Yeah.
Then 20 hours, 43 minutes, the final message is sent from Amelia.
We are on the line 157337, running north and south.
I don't know the coordinates exactly, but that is a line that it would have ran into Howland Island if they were on that line.
Okay.
But again, there's no GPS. They can't like pull out some device and it be like, yeah, you're at these coordinates right now. It was Fred Noonan looking at a map, using dead reckoning, predicting where they were.
Yeah, that signal coming through so strong. It's like, well, she must have been close, right?
Yeah, you would think, right, that they were pretty close. And so, yeah, we're on the line 157337 running north and south. It's the last message ever sent from Amelia. And if they were actually on that line, they would have intercepted Howland Island.
Hmm.
But as everybody knows, she was never heard from again. And that sort of is the end of the crash and sink theory. The idea is maybe the navigation was off just slightly. Maybe the cloud cover didn't allow them to see far enough to spot Howland Island. And they simply ran out of fuel and had to ditch the plane in the ocean.
Yeah.
So that's theory number one.
Have you ever wanted to use a fork and a spoon at the same time?
Oh my god!
Introducing the Foon! It's a spoon with prongs like a fork on the end.
Perfect for baked beans.
Do you love beans?
Yeah.
Does your significant other like beans?
Yeah.
Do your kids like beans?
No.
You need the Foon.
We want foons, Mama! Mama, get us foons! 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 Give me foons or I'm gonna jam this foon in your neck.
Now calm down, little Billy. I've already ordered them. Go to your room, Jimmy.
Not till I get the beans.
Oh, I'll give you the beans.
So anyway, Amelia just died.
All right. So that's theory number one, the crash and sink theory.
Yeah.
The other theory that a lot of people ascribe to him is called the castaway theory.
Wilson!
I was going to make...
Oh, sorry. I stepped on it. Sorry.
No, you're good. You're good.
All right, your turn.
No,
your turn.
You got ahead of me. That's good. I was going to make a deadpan joke about where they ended up on an island with a volleyball. So the castaway theory is, you know, exactly what it sounds like, that they ended up on a different island and lived for some amount of time after the plane went down and then eventually passed away on the island, but that they didn't just crash in the ocean and pass away.
Mm-hmm.
The castaway theory is most often attributed to the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, or as they like to go by, TIGER.
Row.
Row.
Do tigers hiss? I don't know. So this theory is from specifically one group.
So it's a theory people have had for a long time. But long story short, Tiger researched this whole castaway theory. And they came to the conclusion, I think you texted me about this not that long ago, after I said, like, hey, we're going to learn about Amelia Earhart. You texted me something about Amelia Earhart, and it was about Nikumaroro Island. And that is where Tiger has planted their flag, that she crash landed on a reef just off of Nikumaroro Island and survived for some amount of time on that island.
Okay.
So Nikumaroro Island is slightly bigger than Howland Island. It's 4.7 miles by 1.6 miles, and it is 400 miles to the south of Howland Island. And if you kind of look at, like, from Ley, New Guinea, where they took off,
mm-hmm.
and you, like, draw a line to Howland Island and you draw a line to Nikumaroro.
Right.
They're pretty much the same distance from Ley, New Guinea.
Right.
So the final flight happened July 2nd. After Amelia went missing, from July 2nd to July 7th, amateur radio operators all over the United States reported hearing radio broadcasts from Amelia Earhart. I know that sounds insane.
Well, not if, like, if the airplane radio was still functional enough.
Right. So the thinking is that the radio on the Electra was still functioning enough that they could broadcast out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, the complicating factor is they are on the other side of the world. They are in the South Pacific,
mm-hmm.
and the people that reported hearing these radio broadcasts are in the United States.
Oh, okay. I was thinking they were, like, nearby.
No. Now, there is some strange environmental phenomenon that can bounce radio waves off the atmosphere, and you can hear things from really far away. Like, I can remember when I was young, my dad had this whole radio set up in one of the bedrooms of our house.
Mm-hmm.
And if the conditions were just right, he could hear, like, Asian broadcasts.
Okay.
And so it can happen. Now, whether those conditions were met, like, specifically July 2nd through July 7th of 1937, I don't know. I don't know what those conditions are, but it is within the realm of possibility for radio waves to travel around the globe.
Right.
Now, some of these messages, amateur radioists, radio people.
I think go with that.
One of the messages, this is a quote, was, "This is Amelia Earhart, ship on reef, south of equator, station KH9. Please help. And then the most famous instance of these radio broadcasts was from a girl named Betty Klenk, K-L-E-N-C-K. She was 15 years old. She lived in Florida. And as she was listening to these radio broadcasts, she was jotting them down in her diary.
Right.
And what she got was, "This is Amelia Earhart. We are on a reef. Water up to my knees." And another thing that was reported from more than one person, like multiple people reported, that Amelia Earhart was making a lot of references to New York City.
Okay.
And it didn't really make a lot of sense why she would be referencing New York City, right?
Right.
But Tiger put together that in 1929, so 8 years prior to Amelia Earhart's final flight, the SS Norwich City ran aground just off of Nicomororo Island. And so Tiger's thinking is she wasn't saying New York City, she was saying Norwich City.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's not such a reach.
Right. Trying to send out, like, "I'm near the Norwich City," because at the time the ship was just abandoned there. And now it's just deteriorated into nothing.
Well, and if you don't know Norwich City, if that's your closest reference point, you're like, "Oh, New York City," like, it's close enough I could see somebody making that jump.
Yeah. Because a 15-year-old girl in Florida in 1937 is not going to know about the SS Norwich City.
Right, right.
Also, the ship was left there. And so at 8 years later, you could still read on the side SS Norwich City.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be kind of like a landmark that she could radio out to try and get someone to come to her. Because, like, people knew about the SS Norwich City, but not these amateur radio users, radio people.
Well, not a 15-year-old in Florida.
Right. So after Tiger got that, they were like, "Okay, let's put all this together. Let's go to Nicomororo Island and investigate."
Okay.
"Let's go see if we can find any evidence there." And this stuff, I should say, the stuff with Tiger going there and investigating, this isn't a few years after the disappearance. This is like modern times.
Okay.
Like since the 90s, they've gone there and investigated. So they go, and Tiger finds a bunch of physical evidence. They find shoe fragments from a men's shoe and shoe fragments from a woman's shoe that are the style and brands of the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
They find a sextant box, which is a navigational tool used for celestial navigation. They find cosmetic jars, including a jar of freckle cream. And Amelia sort of famously did not like her freckles.
Oh, so it's a cover of them up.
Yeah. They find an aluminum panel that Tiger believes was a window patch on the Electra. So they're finding like quite a bit of physical evidence.
Yeah.
And then I should have led, because this is before Tiger went there. In the years following Amelia's disappearance, a British colonial officer found human remains on Nicomororo Island.
Do you know much about that island? Like, what's its vibe?
It's really just like a small atoll in the middle of the Pacific. An atoll is like a ring of islands with like a shallow lagoon in the middle.
Okay.
That's kind of what Nicomororo Island is. So a British colonial officer found human remains on the island. And this was like only a few years after they had disappeared.
Okay.
It was some skull fragments and some long bones. It wasn't like a whole skeleton that was found.
Okay.
They were analyzed in 1941 in Fiji and determined to be male. And then shortly after they were examined in Fiji, they were completely lost to time. Nobody knows where these bones ended up. So, you know, they're analyzed in Fiji. Whatever doctors or professionals analyzed them in Fiji wrote down all the measurements and notes and everything about these bones. Later, they got analyzed. And a lot of people, when you look up stuff about the Nicomororo theory, you'll see over and over and over again, the bones found on there were found to be male, but they fit Amelia Earhart's proportions exactly.
Mm-hmm.
They were the right size to be Amelia Earhart's.
Yeah.
So they reanalyzed them and they said, yeah, these measurements are the right size to be Amelia Earhart's remains. Now, what nobody I guess, bothered looking into, but I did, is that Amelia Earhart was 5'8". Now, do you want to take a wild guess at what the average height of a man in the 1930s was?
7'3".
They were giants back then.
I'll get in the plane. That sounds great. 5.5 feet to 6 feet, somewhere in there.
So Amelia Earhart was 5'8". The average height of a man in the 1930s, 5'8".
Yeah. Which I think, isn't that still the case now?
I think it's like 5'9". Maybe we got an extra inch. I don't know. So again, yes, if it was the bones of an average size man in the 1930s, it would be the right proportions to be Amelia Earhart. Like, it's just saying that the bones were either Amelia Earhart or the literal top of the bell curve for men's heights in the 1930s.
Well, there must be a way to differentiate between men's bones and women's, right?
Yeah, you could do DNA testing and stuff now, but back then it was like, these are men's bones, you know?
Oh, okay. They're tall. Must be a man.
Now, the other complicating factor for the other evidence that Tiger found, the shoe fragments, sextant box, cosmetic jars, is that, so they disappeared July of 1937. In December of 1938, so about 18 months later, the British decided they wanted to colonize Nicomororo Island. This was actually the last official colonization that the British Empire partook in.
So this was very recent.
Yeah, 1938. They colonized Nicomororo Island. And so essentially what that meant was they just sent a bunch of British people to the island to try and establish some sort of colony and live there. And I don't really know why they wanted Nicomororo Island, but the British appetite for colonization is unmatched.
True.
By the mid-1950s, the population on Nicomororo was around 100, and that was where it peaked. After that, by 1963, the British government decided, okay, this isn't really working out. It doesn't really make sense for us to have people there.
Yeah.
And so they started downsizing the colony. And by 1965, everybody had left, and it's been uninhabited since 1965. And so I say that brief history lesson just to say that we're kind of run into the same problem as we had with the Roanoke episode, the lost colony of Roanoke, where if you remember in that episode, like archaeological digs on Croatoan Island had brought up British and European artifacts that like time-wise line up to the lost colony. But there had been other colonists that we know had been on Roanoke Island. And so some of it could have been the lost colony,
right?
But it could just as well be other colonists. And we kind of run into that here too, where, yeah, some of these things, a sextant box, cosmetic jars, shoe fragments, some of those things very well could be from Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, but there's zero way for us to differentiate them from the British colonists that came the next year because...
Well, or to say if they crashed somewhere else and it just happened to find its way down there from... floating there, right? Like,
I think that would probably be a bit of a stretch just because of how remote Nicomororo is. It would have to float a long way to get to the island. Like, I would say Howland Island, just based on my rudimentary scrolling out on Google Maps. Nicomororo Island, the closest other body of land probably is Howland Island, where she was supposed to go.
Okay.
And then the last bit of evidence from Tiger is the aluminum panel that they found that they said was an aviation panel and that Amelia had used it to patch one of the windows on the Electra. So the stamping on that piece of aluminum have come back and shown that it could not possibly have been manufactured before 1937. And so it's very unlikely that that piece of aluminum was part of her plane.
Yeah, right.
So you have what are called the post-loss radio messages that folks in America said that they heard, have maybe references to the SS Norwich City in those, and you have some physical evidence that's been found on the island. It just can't definitively be tied back to Amelia.
Right.
And so that wraps up the castaway theory.
Okay.
Then we go into this one. I'm just going to be honest. It just seems a little far-fetched to me. But a good contingent of people believe in the Japanese capture theory.
Okay. And to recap, you said two with logic, one possible, one absurd. So this is the one possible.
Yeah, one that's possible.
Okay.
And so this is the Japanese capture theory. And this alleges that Amelia was captured by the Japanese and imprisoned or just kept until eventually she either passed away or was executed. I don't really know what direction people go with this, like how the Japanese would have captured her, because some people will say, well, they shot down her plane. But I feel like if that happens, she's going to be dead when it crashes. And it's just unlikely to me that like the Japanese Navy would be out there chasing her plane down. I don't know. The shooting her plane down doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, and she was reporting, we're flying over you. Like, that part seems pretty documented, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that she's being chased by Japanese Air Force or Navy or whoever.
She would have said something about
that. Yeah, like, hey, there's also a plane shooting at me.
Yeah, you would hope so. I guess the other angle that people come at this one from is that she crash landed on an island, Nikumaru or otherwise, and the Japanese intercepted her and took her prisoner.
Okay.
Now, really the thinking behind this theory, because, you know, you hear that and you're like, well, why in the world would the Japanese care about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that we're in 1937, World War II starts 1939, Pearl Harbor happens 1941.
Yeah.
And so tensions just sort of in the world are increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States had not surveyed any part of the Pacific Ocean since the 1800s. And so sort of the thinking behind this is that Amelia was doing some sort of surveillance or spy mission for the U.S. government.
The most public spy mission of all time.
Well, the thinking is, you know, she is this world famous pilot. You know, it makes sense that she would try and circumnavigate the globe. Let's put a couple cameras in the plane and have her fly over these portions of the Pacific so we can see what's going on.
Yeah.
Now, that alone sounds pretty far-fetched, but Amelia Earhart was a huge celebrity.
Yeah.
And she actually visited the White House and FDR, the president at that time, on numerous occasions.
Mm-hmm.
She was actually really close friends with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Okay.
They famously, one time when Amelia was at the White House for some sort of party or get together or something, she kind of pulled Eleanor Roosevelt to the side and was like, hey, do you want to go on a flight right now? And they sort of snuck out of the party and Amelia flew them to Baltimore. She was very good friends with the highest level of the U.S. government. And so the idea essentially is that because they were such good friends, Eleanor or maybe FDR himself came to her and was like, hey, we could use your help with this stuff. We want to get a survey of the Pacific because tensions are starting to rise. We want to see if the Japanese are doing this or that.
Right.
And sort of get an idea. Right. And so most of the evidence of this theory, or really all of the evidence of this theory, is just firsthand accounts from people who claim they saw Amelia Earhart.
Mm-hmm.
The most famous one is Josephine Blanco Akiyama. She claimed in 1937, shortly after the disappearance, that she saw a white woman matching Amelia Earhart's description on the island of Saipan. And Saipan sort of becomes the hub for this theory, where the Japanese, wherever they captured her, took her to the island of Saipan and interrogated her, imprisoned her, and Fred Noonan as well.
Okay.
So you have a number of people claiming that they saw a white American woman and a man matching Fred Noonan and Amelia Earhart's description. You also have the citizens on Saipan saying, we saw, you know, a redheaded tall woman that was completely out of place here on Saipan around that time.
It would stand out there, I would think.
Yeah. You have a number of eyewitness testimony saying we saw these people. Because Saipan during World War II is invaded by the United States, you know, as they're marching across the Pacific. And you have some accounts of Marines who were on Saipan when we gained control back, saying not that they saw Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, but that there were rumors of her plane being in one of the hangars. I'm sure some of the Marines said that they saw her plane, that sort of thing.
Right.
So you end up having all these firsthand accounts of, yeah, we saw Amelia Earhart on Saipan shortly after her disappearance, right?
Interesting. Okay.
And so that's that theory.
Yep.
Now, it's sort of connected, the just absurd theory. So the Japanese capture theory was really championed by a man named Joe Klaas, K-L-A-A-S.
Well, he doesn't sound very Japanese.
No, he is not. He is not Japanese. But Joe Klaas is not okay with Amelia Earhart simply being captured and then executed by the Japanese. He believes that she was, but he believes she was not executed. Instead, she was released by the Japanese. And if you remember, at the very end of the first episode, I said where he suspects she ended up living. Do you remember where that was?
What's the first letter?
I'll do you one better.
Yeah.
Okay. Today, did you remember to GTL today?
I did. Well, I did gym. I didn't tan, I didn't laundry.
So you G'd.
I G'd up.
G'd up. So Joe Klaas says that she was released by the Japanese and settled into New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
She wanted to live a normal, unassuming life for the rest of her life.
On the Jersey Shore.
And Joe Klaas, I don't have a clue how he researched this, but he determined that Amelia Earhart was living under the pseudonym Irene Bolam. His evidence that Irene Bolam was Amelia Earhart is that they looked alike.
And this got traction?
Well, they had a physical resemblance. They had similar personalities. He specifically said that Irene Bolam was intelligent and independent. So must be Amelia Earhart.
Dead ringer. Yeah.
He said that their handwriting was similar. And so he wrote a book called Amelia Earhart Lives about Irene Bolam being Amelia Earhart. Irene Bolam sued the publisher and won $1.5 million in a lawsuit against the publisher.
Back then, that's huge. That's big money.
This wasn't in the 30s and 40s. This was like later on. This was after she had been captured by the Japanese, released, moved to New Jersey.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know the truth to this or not, but one place that I was researching this on said that after Irene Bolam passed away, Joe Klaas was so convinced of this, he started petitioning to exhume the body so that he could fingerprint it. And when the family very obviously was like, yeah, no, you're not going to do that, he was like, see, why wouldn't they let me unless she was Amelia Earhart?
Like, I'll show you a finger you can print.
Right. So that's the absolute ridiculous theory. Evan's just flicking me off right now. And so those are the theories. You have, I think, the crash and sink theory and the castaway theory have the most traction.
Yeah, for sure.
The captured by the Japanese, I can see where it would make sense, but I think there's a lack of evidence for that one. And then New Jersey is just insane.
That feels like one of those like of the times theories where they were the population that maybe a lot of the US was apprehensive to, given the growing tensions.
You're talking about the Japanese capture theory?
Yeah, that even can loosely tap into some stuff that happened, like would get some legs just based on cultural zeitgeist stuff. Yeah. I feel like we bring that up all the time because it's like, yeah, oh, maybe it was like the people that you guys feel like you can't trust for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Good, bad, biased, racist, etc. It can get legs just based on that, as we see today.
Yeah. So what's your thinking on what happened to Amelia?
I mean, I think it's as simple as we think it is on this one. Normally, I'm the one who's like, got the whiteboard behind me with every theory and like which parts kind of combine.
Yeah.
I think it's crash and sink. I think they got close, a lot of cloud coverage. They had to do so much to kind of adapt their journey at the very tail end to try and find this very small place. I just think it was too much. They couldn't quite find it. And then gas kind of ran out. You know, one of their last radio broadcasts was like, you should see us or we should see you or some variation thereof. I think it was just too much happening with weather to hit that final destination. I think you were saying it sounded like they're going like north and then south and then north and then south just to try and like cover enough water mass. Mm-hmm. I assume you can
water mass
use that as like you can with land mass. But just, you know, like let's comb it like it's got to be here. And the signal was strong. So I don't know. I feel like they were pretty close, just couldn't quite bring it home.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think this is a case of a lot of people wanting it to be more.
Mm-hmm.
They're wanting some extra level of mystery with this case, you know, because she was so famous. She's a feminist icon. To think that they ran out of gas and crashed into the ocean feels kind of anticlimactic, I think a lot of people think.
Yeah, I could see that.
Something in them wants them to have survived on an island for X number of days or whatnot. But I think that, like you were saying, I think just enough things went wrong on this last flight, and most of it out of their control. Storm clouds,
yeah,
boats maybe being parked in the wrong place or in the right place, but another one being 40 miles away that they could have thrown them off in some sort of way. Again, cloud cover, them having to get really low, everything basically making celestial navigation impossible. So they had to rely solely on dead reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
I think just enough things piled up that they ran out of gas and crashed into the ocean, sank, and, you know, everything is just at the bottom of the ocean somewhere right now. I do think that they did their absolute best to make it to Howland Island, and I think they got very close.
Yeah.
I think that radio signal coming through so strong is like the best evidence possible that they were really close.
Yeah.
I think maybe they were just flying too low and they couldn't quite see the Itasca, because I think they're going to see the boat before they see the island.
Yeah. Yeah. When they had their oil furnaces going and all that stuff.
Yeah. The smoke, a beacon into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So I think it's possible that they got 40 miles away. If they had like another 10 gallons of gasoline, they may have made it. I don't know how fast the gas was burning, but I think they got really, really close to Howland Island and just couldn't quite bring it home. That's my thinking on it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think like the talent was there. I mean, like, dude, they were so close.
That's what it just feels like. They were right there.
Yeah.
Obviously, we don't have the technology, but if you took like a 50 mile radius around Howland Island and were able to like scan the depths of the ocean, I'm like 95% that you would find Amelia's airplane that close to the island.
Yeah. For it to come in that strong and that clear, like pretty much somewhere in that neighborhood, right? Just couldn't quite get to the final landing point.
Right. And it's just virtue of, it was the longest leg of the journey. They were going, I think it was like 2,500 miles that day. And they're flying for really the first time in the circumnavigation. They're trying to find a needle in a haystack, right? They're trying to find Howland Island in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah.
There's no other land around. Like, this wasn't like, yeah, we're supposed to land in this part of Africa, but, you know, we're flying over land the whole time so we can find somewhere to put it down.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was, if we don't find this island, we're done. And yeah, they just weren't quite able to.
Which makes you kind of wonder about the previous flight that was canceled. What if they'd gone west, where it's like, let's just go ahead and knock out that really tough part right out of the gate.
Right.
And then if that doesn't work, kind of come back. And I don't know, maybe there was similar difficulties that would have happened going the other direction. But
yeah,
I'm one of those people like, let's just knock out the really scary hard part first and then kind of make sure we're good when we wrap things up. And I'm curious how much of the swap also for the navigator on the plane made that to change going east versus west, or what kind of complications that created from one or the other. But what if they had gone the other way to start off on this one versus switching things up?
Yeah. I will add here at the tail end that after she disappeared, there was an absolutely massive search effort that was undertaken by the U.S. government. Hundreds of planes, thousands of people involved, and even the Japanese got involved in the search for Amelia Earhart. Now, the people that subscribe to that theory are going to say, of course they did, so they could act like they didn't know anything, but, you know, whatever, take that with a grain of salt.
Right.
But yeah, there was an absolutely massive search for Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. No concrete evidence has ever been found of either one of them or the plane. So that's the story of Amelia Earhart. This was a fun one to get into. Of course, I've known about Amelia Earhart for a long time, but I never knew any of the details about the specifics of the flight, why she may have crash landed, the things that went wrong. I didn't really know any of that stuff. And whenever you see Amelia Earhart covered in the media, like if you watch a show or like an episode about Amelia Earhart, they're going to talk about the Japanese capture theory or the Nico Maroro theory, because there's not really any entertainment value in, oh yeah, they crashed in the ocean. Right. And so I feel like a lot of the media surrounding this case gets more sensationalized so that you'll get views and clicks and all that type of stuff.
And I would say there is a entertaining value you could give giving the more likely story. I think the easier route, or what companies making those products see, is like, you know, it'll get butts in theaters.
Yeah, exactly.
If we just give people the least likely theory, which,
Aliens. Oh, there we go. We didn't even talk aliens. About aliens.
No, this one's super cool. I remember, like, I think I did a book report on her like forever ago.
Yeah.
I remember getting into it a little bit. So a lot of the stuff was like kind of coming back as we were talking about it. But I mean, obviously a super cool woman, did a whole lot of stuff for women that wasn't happening back then to kind of like be the torch carrier.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, wish she had made it. Curious what went down. But I think I know where we kind of fall there as far as what we think happened.
Yeah. This is one of my probably like top three. If you could know the answer to a mystery, what mystery would you want? This is probably one of my top three of like, where is Amelia Earhart's plane? But I don't think we ever will.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't think we have any rap songs to close this one out.
I'm going to go ahead and commit next episode, episode 3.
Yeah.
We will be closing that one out with some sort of song. I'm not going to give away exactly what it is. What I will say, and this is quite a statement based on some of the things we've covered. Episode 3 is going to cover the most ridiculous story we have ever covered.
I'm in.
So there will definitely be musical accompaniment. Hopefully that works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So any tease or just
that's where we're going to leave it. Yeah. I hadn't heard about this one until recently. A friend of mine was like, oh, you should cover this. And when I started looking at it, I was like, this is insane.
Okay.
So that's what we're going to cover. It's a ridiculous story. It'll be a fun one.
All right.
So everybody, email me. oddityarchivepodcast@gmail.com. Send me an email if you want to replace Evan for an episode. We can be as insane as we want and make as many edit requests as we want, and he'll have to follow all of them.
But you do have to pretend to be me.
Yeah, you have to pretend to be Evan. We are thinking about some point this season, Evan stepping away from the mic and Ottoman stepping onto the mic for an episode so you all can get a little more familiar with Ottoman.
Yep.
I realized that I've never actually seen Ottoman. This is sort of like a Satoshi Nakamoto situation. I've only ever communicated with him via text. What does he look like?
He's very like floofy. Long hair.
Okay.
Has some eye shine. He's taller than me.
Oh. So he has like long flowing hair.
Yeah, yeah. Like think like we talk about Fabio that one episode. Picture Fabio's hair, but all over.
Oh, okay.
Kind of grunts a lot, smells like
oh, okay.
Whether it's because of what I feed him or just kind of his nature, TBD.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe he'll get on an episode soon. So email me, follow us on Instagram, Oddity Archive Podcast. Thanks for listening. If you like the show in general, tell another human about it, or a dog or a cat, anybody that will get us a listen count.
And you've heard a couple examples of us having people with first person experiences on. Love to do more of that. So yeah, if you have something like that, would love to hear it. Come on. It's a safe space. That's all I got.
Yeah. Please reach out if you've got a story you'd like to share. All right. We'll see you on the next one. I am David Stuhldreher, creator and host. The show is edited by my co-host, Evan Miller. Theme music done by Sean Bullock. You can follow him at Sean Bullock Video on Instagram. All original artwork done by Tanis.
You can follow her at Tannis Tattoos on Instagram as well. Thank you for listening.